Support for WPR comes from Focus on Energy. Committed to helping Wisconsinites focus on the planet by making smart energy choices. Energy resources for Earth Day and every day can be found at focusonenergy.com.
Taking a look at climate and weather now with our weather guy, Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at the UW-Madison, also a professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences. John Martin, professor and chair of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison. Guys, good to see you again.
Yeah, good to see you, Larry.
It's good to be here when we have such great weather in Wisconsin.
Every time you guys are on... It seems like the weather knows your schedule because we always seem to have a very current topic to discuss.
That's true. Yeah.
Right. You know, Hurricane Irene, massive event along the North American coast. John, maybe you can give us a rundown as to why it was so huge, why it caused so much damage.
Well, there are a whole bunch of factors that go into determining whether a storm is going to cause substantial damage or not. One of the ones about Irene is that many of the places that were affected, you know, north of, let's say, the Chesapeake Bay area, haven't seen a hurricane of any magnitude in more than 20 years, in some places longer than that. So that, coupled with the fact that the track was accurately forecasted and the intensity was not quite as accurately forecasted, it actually came ashore as a weaker storm almost from the get-go than it was forecasted to be. It was not a hurricane in New York City. It was not a hurricane in Boston. It wasn't a hurricane in the coast of Maryland, even. It was a tropical storm. But the interesting thing about that, as another fact, is that it doesn't really matter. You're still going to get torrential rains and winds sufficient enough to knock down lots of trees and bring down power. And was it several million people were without power yesterday? It may still be some fraction of that today. So the first really big tropical storm of the year that got itself organized and had a bearing on the coast of the United States... I sure hope that one of the things in the aftermath of this is not that people will say, it wasn't as bad as we thought. Next time we're not going to get out of Ocean City, Maryland. You know, the businesses were all upset that people had to leave for several hours, or people in lower Manhattan might be upset that they had to leave their homes and businesses. But, you know, why would you play games with a storm that's on its way and, you know, not get out of the way of that thing? They had 4 feet of water in lower Manhattan.
Right.
That's enough to cause floods. You know, what's the difference between 4 and 8? It goes up to the top of your kitchen table as opposed to your roof. It still ruins your house. So I don't think it makes too much difference, and I think the mayor did a good job getting people out of there and many other public officials. But what happens next time when a really serious Category 2 or Category 3 storm bears down? You just hope that people don't say, hey, last time it wasn't that bad.
Yeah,
big mistake.
They don't have that memory.
You'd have a tough time, I think, telling Vermonters that it wasn't a terrible storm.
Yeah, there you go.
I mean, the main thing, right, is the difference between a tropical storm and a hurricane is the winds.
That's right.
I mean, they still got a lot of rain, like Vermont.
And on the west side of those storms, traditionally, especially along the east coast, the west side is already a place that's prone to have higher precipitation as a storm, you know, decays into a tropical storm and an extratropical disturbance. But couple that with the Appalachians, the spine of the Appalachians, and you have a disaster in places like Brattleboro and other places in Vermont, completely missed by CNN and a lot of other news agencies because they're focused on the megalopolis. But there's a lot of disaster going on in upstate Vermont.
I like Brattleboro.
That's a great state. That whole state is beautiful.
Yeah, that's a nice city. Visited there a time or two and always enjoyed my stay. And I'm sad to know that there's so much terrible things going on.
Yeah, they've got a tough day today.
Yeah. Well, I haven't given the number, so let me do that. If you have a question, we started here talking about Hurricane Irene, but we can talk about our weather right here in Wisconsin, too, as we visit with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. And you can also go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and you can post a question or a comment. And we've had some great photos, too. If you've got a good weather photo that you want to share, and you can do that by going to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. I hope you do that as well. You know, there's another anniversary. Today is the 6th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina.
That's correct.
Devastated New Orleans. Did Irene have the potential to do similar damage, do you think, had she not weakened?
She was never anywhere close to the strength of Katrina.
I think Hurricane Irene at one point was maybe a strong Category 2, bordering on Category 3, and that was just north of the Bahamas where the water's still pretty warm, and you're definitely in the tropics. Yeah. As soon as it curved northward, it fairly well weakened almost immediately into a weak Category 1 and then tropical storm.
Yeah.
So it never posed that threat.
And a Category 1, what would the winds be for a Category 1?
74 to 95 miles per hour or something like that, or maybe even less than 95. Yeah. Category 3 is 110 and bigger.
Still, you think about it here, you know, we get a 30-mile-an-hour wind here in Wisconsin.
Well, we get 100-mile-per-hour winds, too, from the outflow from the thunderstorms.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. But, I mean, 30, to me, seems like pretty windy.
Yeah, right. It is a lot. Yeah, I heard from a colleague of mine up at MIT, Kerry Emanuel, is a famous hurricane scientist, and he said in his around his house in Lexington, they had sustained 30-knot winds, maybe. But that was enough to take trees down.
Yeah.
Because it's the sustained nature of those winds. You know, when people hear about hurricanes and they've not experienced one, like I haven't exactly experienced one, but I have an idea what a sustained wind of 74 knots is really a remarkably strong wind. It's inescapable wind.
So you've never been in a hurricane?
No.
You've been growing up on the Northeast Coast, huh?
See, I'm one of those people. I'm just over 25, and of course, you know what? It's been
more than
20
years. Over 20.
Oh, man. Linda in Wanakee has a question for you guys. Let's go to Linda. Hi, Linda.
Hi there. How are you?
Great. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. I just want to know the difference between isolated showers and scattered showers.
One's scattered and one's isolated.
Yeah. Scattered. Okay. Well, go ahead.
That's, boy, I don't know the formal definition, but the way that I always think about it, when you talk about isolated showers, you're usually talking about, you know, there may be a thunderstorm, and a weak thunderstorm at that, one or two in the area. But when I think about scattered, types of precipitation, I think of like small storms, like you would get like in Florida, where they kind of, you know, pop up in a whole bunch of different places.
Yeah, that's roughly the way I'd categorize it. And so maybe, Steve, you have the same opinion as I do. If I were trying to tell somebody about what might wreck their picnic, the least wrecking type of weather would be an isolated shower.
Yes.
And then a scattered shower would be the next higher level of, you know, better watch out.
Yeah.
So, yeah, okay, so we share that same view. Yeah.
But I don't know what the formal...
They contradict each other a bit, but who knows?
Well, it's kind of like, you know, partly cloudy or mostly clear.
Right.
What does that mean?
They reflect either a degree of cynicism or optimism.
Yeah. Well, speaking of cynicism, I think, you know, you could just anytime say it's 50% chance of rain. Either it will or it won't.
You got that right. Thanks, Linda.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Judy in St. Croix, Minnesota, on to you. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I have a question about the possible connection between my suffering of asthma this summer with humidity and humidity being possibly caused by an excessive amount of corn being grown and the added moisture in the air from the growing of corn. I've heard that this is a reality.
There's no question at all that if you live near a highly vegetated area, especially if it's corn, because corn is so terribly inefficient at managing water, that when you irrigate that cornfield, it pretty much transpires most of that water right back into the atmosphere as water vapor. So if you're in places like Iowa, southern Minnesota, have really high dew points, and part of that is a consequence of their proximity to the corn. But
okay.
this summer was humid, especially July, first couple of weeks of August, unusually humid here in Madison, too, and we're not surrounded by quite the density of corn as some other places. So it was an unusually humid summer.
But it has the humidity connect to the asthma part?
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe,
I don't know. My wife really suffered this summer.
I wonder if the ozone's a little bit high in air that's humid and maybe got an urban taint to it, you can have maybe some ozone production in the lower part of the troposphere.
So you still get the irritation in the lungs.
Right, that could be one of the links. I don't know. Yeah. Certainly it's a big problem in Houston because they have really thick humidity and, of course, urban polluted air, and the ozone problem there is enormous in the summertime.
Right.
Okay, well, I'll look forward to somebody maybe looking into the asthma connection a little bit closer in the future.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah.
Thank
Good
you
luck
very
with
much.
That.
Thanks, Judy. Tom in Baraboo, let's go to you next. Hi, Tom. Thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you very much. I just like to get your gentlemen's opinions, what they think our winter will be as far as coldness and precipitation. And I'll just hang up and take my answer off the air.
All right.
I actually looked at that before we came over here, and we have equal chances of being above, below, or at normal.
Oh, man.
Boy, that's sticking your neck out.
Yeah. I know how to take the risk.
Yeah. So. Well, no, it's not you. I mean Steve. I mean, that's the Weather Service or someplace there.
Well, I mean, when we do these seasonal forecasts, you really need to see climatological or global changes in big weather patterns. Mm-hmm. And they're just not seeing any shifts in, you know, abnormal one way or the other. And so they don't know what to pick.
One of the keys often is the El Nino or
right,
La Nina.
That's just the normal.
Just normal tropical Pacific Ocean water. So
yeah.
I guess we don't have anything to really hang our hat on for the coming season. Huh?
So we'll just say flip a coin.
Yeah.
Well.
But I think as we get closer and closer, we'll get better and better.
Definitely, that's true.
At figuring that out.
By January,
I'll be able to tell you what, what the winter's like.
Oh, man. Let's go to Dale and Rhinelander. Hi, Dale. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, I was wondering, in recent history, has Wisconsin directly been affected by hurricanes?
Yes, I can think of some times.
There was a recent one there's two ways we get affected. One is we get really great weather, like we're having when Irene was going up the coast. You know, mm-hmm. So the patterns are setting up that way, the large-scale patterns. Mm-hmm. And then there's another way where the moisture from the hurricanes gets pumped up towards our way, and then that can really lead to heavy precipitation.
Right, and those are being better and better understood. These predecessor rain events, they're called. Our colleagues at SUNY Albany have come up with a good explanation of some of the interactions between high latitudes like us and tropical systems that come in, let's say, on the Gulf Coast. And Steve, you're right, that August 2008 or 2007,
we had
an enormous amount of rain here. Some parts along Mississippi had 12 inches of rain in a couple of days or something like that.
I remember that.
We had 4 or 5 here in Madison. It was really desperately wet.
And then there was that October storm, right, that turned out to be connected to the tropical Pacific.
Yeah, last October, our big storm was off the offspring, in a way, of Typhoon Meggy that hit the Philippines. And that was about a week later that we got hit by that thing. So there's
nothing direct. There's these teleconnections.
That's right. Yeah. And sometimes the Atlantic storms that bring the moisture directly to places like southern Wisconsin, that's a more of a direct connection than the one in October. Yeah.
Sure.
Wow. So, yeah, I was trying to remember the typhoon, all the way from...
Yeah, it changes the whole structure of the tropopause and creates more intense jets across the Pacific Ocean, and they have consequences downstream. It's really an interesting story. We're trying to learn more and more about it.
They add energy to those cold front systems.
Boy, it's amazing.
Steve Ackerman, John Martin are our guests today, and they will be with us right up until 12:30 here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Weather is the backdrop for pretty much everything we do, but sometimes it really asserts itself and moves to center stage. 6 years ago today, we had Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans and the Gulf Coast, and over the weekend, of course, we had Hurricane Irene, crept her way up the East Coast, caused significant damage in some places, but having a more mild effect in other places. Larry Mueller here. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Steve Ackerman and John Martin are weather guys from UW-Madison, and they will share their knowledge of climate and weather and, of course, answer your questions. Happy to answer those questions when you call in at 1-800-642-1234. That's one way to do it. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. And don't forget to check our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. For updates, post your comments and photos, too. We'll be back right after the news. Turning our attention to climate and weather with our weather guy, Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, and John Martin, professor and chair of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison. Lots to talk about with them, and I know Rob in West Bend's been waiting a long time, so let's just go right to Rob, see what's on his mind. Hi, Rob. Thank you for calling.
Hey, Larry, thanks for taking my call. I got a question to Steve and John about this. It's been kind of on my mind for, 20 years or so. Hmm. And back a long time ago, about 20 years ago, lived in Chicago, and we would go smelt fishing in Montrose Harbor. And if you're kind of familiar with it, Montrose Harbor has this big, long cement breakwater, probably a quarter mile long, goes out, and the only thing on it is these I-beams driven into it, and a big metal cable that goes through it. Hmm. So we're going to go smelt fishing, and an electrical storm kicks up. okay? Hmm. And we thought, well, we're not going to turn around because it's great. There's nobody else out there, you know?
Other than the electrical storm.
So this was perfect. And I swear, we're the only people walking out there. And what we're using to smelt fish is a dip net. And a dip net is this kind of big net that comes out apart in pieces, things like 12 feet wide. And so we have all these aluminum pieces taken apart. We're walking with them next to the metal cable. And the big crane that we use to fasten the smelt net, that's metal also. So all we're doing is walking along with these big metal things.
Is that all?
That's all. That's all.
That's all we're doing.
Yeah.
And
in the water, too, right?
Yeah, in the water. We're the only thing out there. We're the tallest thing, you know, for a quarter mile out into the harbor.
So what happened?
Yeah.
Well, we're walking along, and we can see lightning actually hitting the John Hancock Center, the John Hancock building, the towers there. So we know it's kind of iffy. We're kind of getting a little more nervous as we're walking out. Well, what happens now is all of a sudden we hear a noise, and I stop, and I go, what's that noise? And it's kind of a humming, like that. It is the poles, the aluminum poles that we're carrying. What is going on?
Did it glow at all, or was it just vibrating?
Just, I couldn't even tell if it was vibrating, but it was making noise.
Was it daytime?
It was early evening.
Early evening. What I'm wondering if it's a thing called St. Elmo's fire, where the metal gets charged up, and then it begins to, I guess it's losing electrons, or then it begins to glow like a purple thing.
But this one's hollow, so maybe it makes a little bit of sound.
Oh, right. Yeah, like Moby Dick. Yeah. I mean, St. Elmo's fire is the patron saint of sailors, because they're usually associated with you're not getting hit by lightning.
Yeah,
so
right.
So I think it's protecting
you're
you.
You're just getting scared to death.
Yeah. But right, John is just saying if the aluminum poles are hollow, you know, and you're getting Elmo's fire, that might help the ringing of of those poles, too.
Yeah, they would be hollow, for sure.
Yeah,
you can't hold out
that net otherwise.
No,
right?
There you go. Thanks, Rob, for calling. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm glad you survived.
Me, too.
Yeah. Oh, man. Madeline and DePere, on to you. Hi, Madeline.
Hi. My question is about rainy season. I've lived for the last 2 years in Guatemala, and from May until October, it rains. It doesn't rain constantly, but every day it rains. And then from November till April, it doesn't rain. So what are the big weather systems that cause rainy seasons in those tropical countries?
Yeah, you've got something called the intertropical convergence zone that is affecting you in the warm season in the northern hemisphere. That the so-called ITCZ, if we abbreviate it, is the line just north of the equator in the tropics in the northern hemisphere where the strongest surface convergence exists, and it's there for most of that five-month period, and you get towering thunderstorms almost continuously. They pulse maybe with the cycle of the daytime heating, but every day you'll get one. And then when the southern hemisphere warms up and the northern hemisphere cools off in our wintertime, it's just the opposite. That ITCZ moves further south, and so you're left in Guatemala without any substantial threat for precipitation day to day.
Yeah, so as that ITC is moving, as it goes over you, you get the rainy season, and then it's by, and you get your dry season.
Yeah.
That's what happens.
Mm-hmm. That's a fundamental driver of the general circulation of the atmosphere, of the whole planet.
And actually, if you look at a satellite image of the whole planet, you'll see that band right around that area of just bands of thunderstorms.
Yeah.
It's pretty persistent.
When I lived in Trinidad, in the rainy season, the clouds had it seemed as though they were stacking up over the mountain range, and then once the light came, in the morning, then they would pass over and...
Yeah, I mean...
I don't know if that's true or not.
Way to get a rainy season is through a monsoon season, where you get a heating of the land versus the water around it. And that, again, will give you a rainy season, and then in the wintertime, usually, it kind of gets reversed and you dry out again.
Yeah, in fact, in a place like Guatemala, you have that contributing in the same direction as the ITCZ, so that's right. That's right.
So there you go, Madeline.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And Lila, on to you now in Juneau. Hi.
Hi. I have a question, and I think it's a bit of a old wives' tale. I've heard it a few times when I was younger, but I don't remember the date. And I was told that if you measure the rainfall from a certain day to a certain day in inches, that will tell you how much snow you're going to have the following winter. And I was wondering if there was any truth to that and if they knew what the dates were.
You know, we had a call about this, I'd say, about a year or two ago. And so I don't remember the dates. But what I do remember is John quickly calculating the probability of actually being correct. And it turned out that it wasn't, as I remember, it wasn't so bad that you would be hitting the normal type of conditions.
I don't remember that. But it reminds me, that story reminds me of the old thing about the groundhog, you know, which people pay close attention to. Mm. February 2nd is almost exactly 6 weeks away from the spring equinox. So it doesn't really matter what you say. the problem is engineered so that you get pretty close to the right answer in every single year. And so this might also be true, although we don't know the dates and the amount of precipitation. Mm-hmm. But the idea, I guess, is that if you have a wet summer, you're going to have a snowy winter. And I don't know if that's actually true or not. So I would guess that's not true more than 50% of the time.
Yeah, because I didn't really... You know, maybe I was told the dates when I was younger, but of course I forgot them. And then someone else from a different source brought them up again. And I said, yeah, I did hear about that. And I couldn't remember it either. But I just wanted to say again that I really enjoy all the shows and the computer and the gardening and this kind of a show. Everything is really great. So you guys keep up the good work.
Thank you, Lila. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Oh, that's nice to hear. Yeah. Got a Facebook question from Rich. Please comment on what will happen when we lose the satellites used to track weather. They've reached or are beyond their useful life and haven't been replaced due to budget cuts. Back to poor Richard's almanac or the farmer's almanac?
Let's hope we don't have to go back.
We don't want to go there.
Yeah.
It's a step backwards, but we're prone to doing that recently.
There's two things that I think with regard to satellites that are going on. We have the what I'll call the weather monitoring, weather forecasting support satellites that are usually run by NOAA.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got those geostationary satellites up and running pretty good, and we have a new one to be launched hopefully in 2015. So I don't think we're going to be losing those unless some real disaster effect. If we did, it would be a disaster in terms
sure
of weather
would.
Forecasting, not to have that bird's eye view. The other aspect of it is the type of weather satellites that NASA tends to run, which are more research satellites, where we're using them to try and understand how the atmosphere works. And we're losing those satellites. I mean, they're getting aged, and NASA's not replacing them for a variety of different reasons. So I think that our understanding of the atmosphere is going to begin to slow down as we begin to lose those satellites, which is unfortunate.
It is. It's very unfortunate. We have a confusion about spending and investment. They're not the same thing.
Not the same thing, right.
Scott in Madison, it's your turn next. Hi, Scott.
Larry, Steve, John. Mm-hmm. I have, in the late 80s, I taught myself how to read the winds aloft, the 12 and 24 hour prog charts, the different millibar height charts, and all those things were lots of raw data and full of information. And if you used them enough, you could page through them and keep track in your mind and monitor trends and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Then all of a sudden, we start getting more user-friendly weather, and things are converted into color and animation. And now we also have search engines that will bury something. So I've tried several times to try and find a resource for those old charts, or maybe they're not old charts, but relative to what's available today. I just can't find them anymore, and I'm wondering if maybe there's some place that they're there, and that's what the weathermen are using today to turn into color, and they're just not at the front of the page, or
they're still out there. They're still available, and when we get back, I'll try and find them and maybe send them to Larry, and he can post them on his Facebook page where their location are. Yeah, because I came across them. It must have been about 2 months ago. I was looking for some prognostic chart, and it was just like, oh, wow, I remember that from the
1990s.
So they still produce them.
I struggled, too, finding some sources for that kind of information last fall, and it wasn't so easy to find them. But Steve's right. They're out there, and I did find a couple of places. I don't have the websites memorized. But it is important to know that the stuff that was on those old DIFACS charts, if those are the ones you're talking about, that's still the information that's used for the initialization of current forecast models, whether they're portrayed in color or not. Sometimes they don't come with the observation quite as nicely. But our own department webpage has the real observations at all of the various isobaric levels twice a day around the whole hemisphere. So you can find it at www.aos.wisc.edu. Then click on weather as one of the options, and then go to observation maps, and you have a selection of upper-level charts that you can look at that are very much like the old time.
Yeah, kind. That's true. I forgot about that.
So that's one place you can get them.
Yeah.
And they're the data. The black and white charts with the location data.
Yeah, they plot the raw data on there as well as analyze it and draw the contours connecting various.
Right. I wouldn't trust the contours because that's done by a computer nowadays. Yeah. But maybe it always was, but it's done relatively poorly in many instances. But the data is actual data from the real radiosondes.
Well, right. That's great. I'll definitely be looking at Larry's website, so I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Yes, Steve, just send
it. Yeah, I'll send it to you.
Shoot it over to me, and I'll post it right away. Daniel and Rice Lake, on to you. Hi, Daniel.
Hello. We had a hurricane of sorts up here. The north side of McLean Lake, west of Minong, was ravaged by the storm Friday before July 4th. I'm sure you are aware of that storm system. I was watching near a family cabin. The storm was building to the south so rapidly, I thought, where do I go? So I drove around the corner to a brother-in-law's place that is more open, fewer trees. A tree fell 10 feet behind my S10 Blazer.
Oh, man. Ooh.
But there I had a better view of the clouds and took 9 pictures. At times, there appeared to be 3 wall clouds. The turbulence before was striking. My question is, how could a storm like that generate 100 to 125 mile-per-hour winds?
Yeah, this is a straight-line wind event, and I think I do remember hearing about this.
Yeah.
These are deep thunderstorms that occur usually in an environment that's on the eastern side of an upper-level ridge, which is a little bit further to the west than in that case. And as a consequence of that position, these thunderstorms can tap into extremely high momentum, high wind speed air that's up at about 6 or 7 miles above the ground. And the thunderstorms are so intense that they can mix. They mix not only the properties of the air like temperature and moisture, but they can also mix wind speed rather abruptly. And so in the environment of these deep thunderstorms, these powerful thunderstorms, you can drag air that has a horizontal wind speed of 100 miles per hour right down to the ground in less than a couple of minutes. And as a consequence, it doesn't lose much of its speed. And when it hits the ground, it just moves out at the exact same speed it had 6 or 7 miles above the ground a few minutes ago. And that's how those storms can do it. They actually drag that high momentum air right out of the sky and bring it to the surface.
And you did the right thing to get into a clear, open area to avoid, because that's the real danger, is trees just get blown right over.
Yeah, so you're like at the end of a bowling alley, and here come the pins falling down. That's exactly what it's like.
Well, that's kind of scary.
Yeah, you're in a forested area, that's true.
Right,
you got to get out of there.
When the trees are all whipping around like that, it's a little bit freaky, because I was outside in the blazer watching this thing. But over in one of my favorite hunting sites over by the name of Coggan, which was devastated over there, a park ranger told me that it was definitely a tornado. So I drove along a frontage road on the other side of the river, and in one place the trees are bending over to the towards the south, and then just in a few feet they're going straight to the east.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That would be indicative of tornadic activity, I take it.
Yeah, occasionally you can get really strong eddies that may even have tornadic nature to them on the front line of these straight-line windstorms. So they can be hybrids of these kinds of things. That's exactly correct.
Yeah.
And that straight-line winds also caused a siege effect in Lake Michigan. So
as it
moved across Lake Michigan, it pushed all the water from the west end of Lake Michigan to the east end. And then when it crossed over into New York, all that water sloshed back. And you can see in the buoys, all of a sudden, this big 2-3 foot wave just go, woo!
Thank you very much, Daniel. And if you want to share any of those photos, I would love to have you post them on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. I'd love to see them. Thank you again. Thor in Whitewater, we'll turn to you next. Hi, thank you for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. My question was, the possibility of a storm system picking up part of the leftover oil spill from the Gulf and bringing it inland.
I think the way that it would do it is more of a wash-up effect as opposed to scooping it up and then dumping it over. Mm. So sort of like the you know, the surge of water that you get associated with storms pushing that up.
Yeah, and it's I don't know where all that oil is.
I'm wondering if it's already pushed up on land.
Some of it's sunk.
Some of it's been pushed up, or it's been sunk. It's been kind of incorporated into other types of you know, substance in the water and so on. So it's kind of mixed together now. So it may be hotter to.
It's still a problem, but it's not as obvious a problem.
Right.
Yeah. Thank you for calling. You can join in too, by the way. We still have time for a quick question or two at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. We'll get you on pretty quick. Email from Richard. I was curious about the salt content of the water that comes from a hurricane. Is this all fresh water, or is the salt content considerably higher than we would encounter in storms here in Wisconsin?
The salt content of the water that's actually falling out of the sky?
Yes.
I don't think it would be very different at all.
I wouldn't think so either.
Because you can't evaporate salt, whether you're in the tropics or in your high latitudes. You can evaporate the water that might have salt particles in it.
But the winds would whip the salt water up and could evaporate it that way, or add salt.
Yeah, you could have bigger. You could have salt nuclei. Yeah. I guess you could have a lot of solution.
But the precipitation amount is so big
that
the dilution would probably be about the same.
Right. Maybe even less. It might even be more fresh because of the quantities of water.
Water.
It's possible.
Yeah. And we had a Facebook comment as well from Jim, who says, "I'm a Hurricane Katrina survivor on the sixth anniversary of this horrific day. Remember, the Gulf Coast still needs help. Deep scar that may never heal. Prayers to all who have had to endure such catastrophes. Godspeed to the East Coast."
Yes.
Yeah.
I agree. Those are good thoughts.
Some of the news shows were on this morning were showing all the work that still has to be done. A lot of work been done.
But there's a lot to be done. Yeah.
There's still a lot to be done.
That was a devastating event. And, you know, it was made more devastating by some of the problems they had in managing the aftermath of the disaster. But certainly the forecast reminded me a lot, thinking about this weekend during Irene. The forecast for Katrina was locked on solid and was accurate 36 hours in advance. Very similar to what we were thinking about over the early part of the weekend with Irene. Everybody knew when it was going to make landfall in North Carolina and where it was going to go next. And real triumph for the Weather Service again.
Yeah.
So,
Alan in Eagle River, let's go to you next. Hi, Alan.
Hello. A couple of months ago, you had a question about how long it takes for the sunrise to go across the state of Wisconsin. And in the back of the hunting books, it shows it takes about 20 minutes. Where it tells you the different sunrise times for starting hunting.
Wow.
I don't remember that question, but you know, there's a trick way that you can see that, too, in real time, which is the NEXRAD radar page that we have on our website. If it's a clear day, and as the beam is scanning, and it goes into the sunrise, which is barely above the horizon, it receives a huge amount of electromagnetic radiation. It's a little spike, and you can see the spikes happen first at Milwaukee or Sullivan, and then later on in the morning, about 15 minutes later, actually, at La Crosse.
They
happen at the same time. Yeah, that's interesting. So that's about in line with what you're saying.
So about 20 minutes.
Yeah.
What it takes.
I like that.
Oh, very cool. Thanks, Alan, for
thanks for looking that up.
And Don and Coleman, on to you. Don, hi.
Hi. Say, if I look at my compass and I see that the compass is pointing north, and I shoot an arrow that way, I have shot to the north.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
If the wind is blowing the same direction, it's a south wind.
That's right.
That's correct.
Yep.
And it's also a southerly wind.
That's also correct.
Yep. So in meteorology, we measure the wind direction from the direction the wind is blowing.
From which it's coming. Yeah.
Oceanographer does currents differently.
Yeah, exactly the opposite.
Yeah,
exactly, and that has confused me for years.
And I think that's on purpose. They did that on purpose to all of us.
Right.
Because there's more of us than there is of them. They ought to just buckle down and take our lead on that.
I understand. Thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Oh, man. And maybe a quick question from Doug here. Hi, Doug in Green Bay.
Hey, good morning. When I go to my website to try and get a picture of the weather, what's the difference when I click on either a radar reading or a satellite reading? And another question is, are these all generally, regardless of whose site I'm using, do they all get their information from the same source?
Almost all of them we'd be getting from the same source, and that's the National Weather Service, particularly the satellites. That's where it's coming from. The radars, every now and then you'll find a a radio station or a television station that'll have their own radar, a small radar. But, yeah, the main difference is the radars are sitting on the ground, and they measure precipitation, and the satellites are up in the sky, and they're really looking at cloud cover.
Right, yeah.
Okay, so it's usually very similar information, isn't it?
Well, I wouldn't say that. I'd say that one of the first order thing that I notice is that from the satellite picture compared to the radar picture at the same time is you notice that only a fraction of the clouds are actually precipitating, because
right.
the radar tells you what's actually precipitating, and the satellite tells you where it's cloudy. So there's a difference there that's usually quite striking.
But keep looking at them, because it's provided by your government.
You bet. That's taxpayer dollars
at work. And it's free.
It's been a revolution.
I'll take everything I can get.
You bet. There's been a revolution of information. There's these radars all over the place at ball fields. And people know how to use them. I think it's great.
It's amazing, yeah.
Well, you guys are amazing. You'll be back in a month.
We'll be back in a month.
Yes, we will.
Little school will be in full swing.
Force. We'll forget what summer even means.
We'll be on our way to fall.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison, one of our guests, and, of course, the other, John Martin, professor and chair of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison. And they will be back the last Monday of, oh my goodness, September. Already here. Just to take a look ahead, tomorrow we'll learn about how breweries and distilleries shaped Wisconsin or Milwaukee's history when we visit with Martin Hintz, the author of A Spirited History of Milwaukee's Brews and Booze. And then at 11:45, author and historian Erica Janik will talk about quack medicine. Stay with us.
Ever since her husband lost the ability to speak after a stroke, Diane Ackerman has been grieving. And she's found that her sense of loss has connected her with the grieving of others, including animals. I'm Jean Faraca. Join us today at 3 here on Earth.
Support for WPR comes from Southwest Health Center in Platteville, dedicated to meeting the needs of the community with after-hours urgent care services. More information at southwesthealth.org.